The Supreme Court has ruled that LGBTQ people now have legal protections from workplace discrimination. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 16th, we break down the SCOTUS decision and how it follows a Trump administration move to remove health care protections for trans people. Also, the complicated history of the Georgia agency investigating the killings of Rashard Brooks and Ahmaud Arbery.
The earliest history of how the GBI developed in Georgia is inextricable from the roots of the Ku Klux Klan, both in local law enforcement agencies and among the earliest leaders of the GBI.
Then how artist B.L. Sherrell is using music to help formerly and currently incarcerated people craft their own.
All walks of life, we have people who have never been in prison sometimes come in and help us out. It's the ultimate equalizer, music is, in my opinion.
Let's get started. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark decision protecting LGBTQ plus employees from discrimination on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. The news was gratifying for many in the LGBTQ community, especially following the Trump administration's decision last Friday to roll back Obama-era health care protections for transgender people. In the majority opinion, Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, wrote, quote, "The answer is clear. An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex." Gorsuch was joined by fellow conservative Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's four progressive justices, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer. For more on what this decision means for the LGBTQ plus community, we're joined now by Catherine Franke, professor at Columbia Law School and director of Columbia Law School's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
It's my great pleasure.
Also with us is Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Dahlia, the nuts and bolts of this decision, it protects LGBTQ employees from what exactly?
Well, it protects them under the plain language of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 from discrimination, quote, because of sex. And the other groups that had been protected were folks who were discriminated against on the basis of race, religion, national origin, and sex. Now there's no longer any question that if you are discriminated, in this case it was employment discrimination, but presumably it sprawls out to other forms of discrimination. If sex was the basis of that discrimination, then now you are swept in if you are gay or transgender. And it really was, I think, an astonishing decision insofar as there's just not any question that that is now the fact.
Catherine, there were three cases and people who were at the center of this decision. Two of them have passed away since before the decision was made. Can you remind us who Amy Stevens and Donald Zarda were?
Well, Amy Stevens was an employee at a funeral home who, when she began her work with that funeral home, she presented as male. And then during the time that she worked there, she transitioned and showed up for work one day and said, "I am now a woman and I will be coming to work as a woman and want to be regarded as a woman by my employer and by the people who were the customers of that funeral home." And her employer fired her because she was transgender. And, you know, particularly during this period of COVID, where we know people who work in funeral homes are just doing an incredible service for our country, for people we love. It's a very tough time for all of us. The kind of inhumanity of the ownership of this funeral home to fire Amy Stevens, who was doing this incredible work, was crushing for so many people. And of course, she passed away several months ago before she could know that she had won her case. Being a plaintiff in a case like this is a real burden. You know, the kind of public attention you get, personal attacks from people who are opposing transgender rights are just unrelenting. And so she's a real hero in so many ways, standing up for transgender people, for the rights of transgender people, and then winning this case. And we just all hope she's looking down and smiling in this happy moment.
Dahlia, when we talk about these protections, often they sound, you know, very good on paper. I'm wondering if you can tell us exactly how these protections will now be applied in the workplace. Because one of the most difficult things when it comes to cases involving discrimination is really proving said discrimination or proving intent of that discrimination. So explain to us how this is going to be applied.
That's right. And I think it's important also to point out that not every workplace is subject to Title VII protections. It depends on the number of people that you employ. And so Catherine may know better than I, the statistic that I've been hearing is there are still 18% of LGBTQ workers who would not be covered because they just work for very small businesses that are not subject to Title VII. But you're exactly right. This is not by any means the end of the story. It simply means that you can make a claim now if you are fired for being gay or for gender identity. Then you can make a claim that the basis of the firing was discrimination. You still have to prove it, as you said. You have to prove, still meet a fairly high bar to say, for instance, that the reason for the firing wasn't pretextual. So you're quite right. You still have to make a case, and by no means does that mean that everyone will prevail. But I do think it's important, and folks forget this, that over half the states did not have state civil rights protections. So if you were fired explicitly for being gay in most of the states, you had no recourse. And so at minimum, I think we can say at least now we know that the playing field all around the country in every state is equal. And while, again, it's not a slam dunk, you'll prevail in litigation, at least you do have this protection that didn't exist just this time yesterday.
Catherine, the decision was 6-3, as we mentioned at the top of the segment. Justice Neil Gorsuch, who is a Trump appointee, wrote the majority opinion. Many are saying that that was notable. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and the fact that Chief Justice John Roberts also weighed in on this.
Well, most of us who are court watchers in this area were expecting us to lose this case, and that the argument that Justice Alito makes in his dissent that the issue should be resolved by Congress, that they should amend Title VII and include sexual orientation and gender identity protections. We expected that that would be where the court would go in its majority opinion. But that didn't happen. And not only did we get six votes, but Neil Gorsuch, a conservative, widely regarded conservative, wrote the opinion. Now, the fact that Justice Roberts also joined the majority meant that he could assign the opinion to Justice Gorsuch, whereas otherwise someone like Justice Ginsburg might have written the opinion, and we would have gotten a very different reasoning in the case had Justice Ginsburg written the opinion as opposed to Justice Gorsuch. And I'll just note that while it's fantastic that we won, and we clearly won in this case, the opinion reads very, it's kind of a mechanical reasoning. It's very sort of logical, almost machine-like reasoning about how to interpret the word sex in this kind of context. What we don't see in the opinion is sort of soaring, impassioned language about why we have a tradition of protecting equality in the workplace, why this is a fundamental American value, why we passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and why these sorts of workplace protections are so important. And what concerns me about it, as we think down the road, and there will be religious objectors to complying with this rule, is that on the one hand, when the court writes about religious liberty, it does so with an impassioned, heartfelt commitment to religious liberty as a fundamental American value. And on the other hand, we have this kind of mechanical reasoning about Title VII and workplace equality. And when those two values face off, I'm a little concerned about not having language we can pull from this decision to say the state has a compelling interest in protecting workplace equality that can compete with the state's compelling interest in protecting religious liberty.
Catherine, we're going to talk about more about the Trump administration's decision to roll back protections for transgender people in our segment coming up. But I'm just curious whether or not this decision by the Supreme Court sort of nullifies the Trump decision on transgender healthcare protections, or are they still two separate things?
Well, yes and yes. This was specifically a case about workplace discrimination interpreting just one particular statute, Title VII. But the court's reasoning, I think, was broad enough that any good advocate is going to argue that wherever sex-based discrimination protections are in place, either on the federal level or on the local level, they should be interpreted to include sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. And any government actor who's going to deny that is going to have a very steep hill to climb in order to persist in a narrow reading of what sex-based discrimination protections mean.
Dahlia, one of the interesting things, and I say interesting in air quotes here, about the current administration has been how successful the current administration has been in terms of judge placements in lower courts. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on what this decision could mean for lower courts, which have essentially been dramatically reshaped by the Trump administration.
It is the question. I think that we often forget that while we focus all our attention on the U.S. Supreme Court, they hear a tiny fraction of the cases that are appealed up, and that the vast, vast majority of litigation in this country in federal courts gets resolved at the federal circuit courts, the appellate courts, that you're quite right. Trump has utterly transformed. I think he's at 200 judges, at least at the appellate level, one in four judges is now a Donald Trump appointee. And I think you're also right to point out that an awful lot of these judges are very young. They're going to be sitting for a long time. And actually, some of these religious liberty cases are where they made their bones as young lawyers. An awful lot of them fought very hard against reproductive justice and marriage equality. That's one of their single common traits. Now, at the same time, they're bound by the Supreme Court ruling. They can't make it go away. But I think you're going to see real pushback and the kind of parsing that Catherine flicks at when she says it's not soaring languages, it's not sweeping protections. So I think you will see lower courts try to, if not overtly nullify this ruling, certainly cabinet, say, as little as possible to limit it to employment and to push back on the theory that at some point they can seat someone else on the Supreme Court and make this go away.
This is a topic that we will be watching for quite some time. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. And Catherine Franke is a professor at Columbia Law School and the director of the Columbia Law School Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Of course.
Yesterday's Supreme Court ruling cemented protections against workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. But the ruling also comes days after the Trump administration approved another rule rolling back Obama-era health protections for trans people. And that comes at a moment when organizers are drawing attention to the disproportionate rates of violence faced by transgender women of color. Here's activist Raquel Willis speaking at a rally in Brooklyn on Sunday.
You know, I might get in some trouble for saying this. And yes, the legislation matters, but white queer folk get to worry about legislation while black queer folk is worrying about our lives.
Joining me now to talk about the transgender rights movement and where it goes from here is Shelby Chestnut, Director of Policy and Programs at the Transgender Law Center. Shelby, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And just so our listeners are aware, the Transgender Law Center is the organization that filed a brief in the Supreme Court case in support of Amy Stevens. Shelby, how much does the SCOTUS decision shift the legal landscape for transgender rights in the United States?
I mean, yesterday's opinion was welcome news and a historic victory for LGBT people, and I think for trans people, a victory that we didn't see necessarily coming in the ways that we thought it would. But I also think if we're going to make this historic victory meaningful, to Raquel's point, we need to lift up the leadership of Black trans people and ensure that they stay alive.
So there is an exemption for Title VII for religious organizations in this ruling. How much do you think that is going to complicate workplace protections for transgender people in particular?
I mean, I think what we do need to remember is that the highest court in the country made it clearly that LGBT people are a protected class with employment and covered within sex-based protections to include trans people. So I think they will attempt to roll things back, but I also think that we have sort of legal precedents on our side to continue to fight this.
Last week, as we mentioned, the Trump administration rolled back the Obama-era rule that protected transgender people from discrimination by healthcare providers and insurers. Where does that rule? I mean, we just heard at the previous segment that this could really, the Supreme Court ruling might even trump, no pun intended, that decision to roll back those protections. But where do you see that headed?
Yeah, I think it is like a both and to some extent. And I think that yesterday's opinion made it very clear that transgender people are a protected class and to some extent can and will void Trump's attempt to limit access to health care for transgender people. Obviously, that will need to get seen in courts and debated. And there will be many attempts to limit trans people's access to health care. But given that this ruling is now here, it sets precedent for us to have an argument that actually we're a protected class and you can't continue to gut our rights at every attempt.
You mentioned, and at the top of this segment, we had a clip from one of the rallies that took place here in New York City to protect Black trans lives. According to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 14 transgender and gender nonconforming people have been killed so far this year. But violence against the transgender community is disproportionately directed at Black transgender women and other transgender women of color. Shelby, how much do legal decisions like this one actually matter to transgender people of color?
I mean, I think they're hugely important, and I think also it points to the disparities that trans people of color, specifically Black trans women, face around the country, especially regions like the South and the Midwest, where there's limited access to rights and resources. And, you know, I think what we are clear on is that there's been an epidemic of violence against Black trans women for many decades, and it's been fought by many people, and now is the moment where we shift our energy to the long legacy of ending that violence against Black trans women and prioritizing the needs of trans people of color across the country, because we know that legal rights are important, but it's also harm reduction. It's not going to ensure that we have our day-to-day lives protected and that we're not killed in the streets for being who we are.
And does this often, I mean, often hear the conversation in this country is that we don't often see violence as a public health issue. Is that where you stand when it comes to violence against transgender people, particularly Black transgender women? Should this be seen as a public health issue as opposed to an issue of criminality?
I mean, I definitely think it's a public health issue. I mean, there's study after study, especially ones that we've led at the Transgender Law Center through our Positively Trans program, which works with trans people living with HIV. A disproportionate number of folks in that program are Black trans people in the South, and they've unequivocally said that when our basic needs are not met, like access to health care, access to jobs, access to shelter, that we're more susceptible to violence and more likely to be killed. And I think it's a moment where we actually need to shift our focus from just seeking legal protections to naming the problem for what it's been for many years. And everyone should be putting their resources and time and energy into addressing this epidemic of violence.
Shelby, we saw a huge turnout for the rally for Black trans lives here in New York over the weekend. What is it that the LGBTQ movement needs to do better going forward to make sure that some of the policy victories that it is achieving are really inclusive and not just for white LGBTQ people?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I was at the rally in Brooklyn over the weekend, and I had never seen anything like that in my many years of organizing and trans rights. So I was heartened to see so many people out in the streets supporting trans rights and really naming that. I think right now is the moment to look around your community and find the Black trans organizers, find the Black trans women leading this work and support their leadership and find those organizations to lift up, to donate to organize with, to ask them what they need in this moment to sort of survive this moment that we're in.
Shelby Chestnut is the Director of Policy and Programs at the Transgender Law Center. Shelby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last Friday in Georgia, police shot and killed 27-year-old Rashard Brooks in a Wendy's parking lot after officers tried to arrest him when he failed a sobriety test. Brooks's case is now being investigated by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, an independent state agency a bit like the FBI, but exclusively for the state of Georgia. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is the 48th time this year that the GBI has investigated officer-involved shootings. One such case is the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and its handling by local police. The GBI has a complicated history with the agency being accused of having ties with the KKK and allegedly mishandling past investigations. And with the Bureau taking on recent explosive instances of police violence against Black men, there will be even more scrutiny of its handling of cases like Brooks's and Arbery's. Here to help us understand the GBI's history and importance in this moment for Georgia is Akayla Lacey, a politics reporter for The Intercept, who's done deep reporting into the GBI. Akayla, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Where did the GBI come from? What's its origin story?
So the GBI started, decades ago in Georgia as a way to basically investigate law enforcement agencies. It's like a detective agency to investigate criminal and civil cases regarding the state and handle specifically cases of police misconduct and police killings. In Georgia, the story that I wrote dug into the earliest history of how the GBI developed in Georgia, which is inextricable from the roots of the Ku Klux Klan, both in local law enforcement agencies and among the earliest leaders of the GBI. One of the first leaders was a known Klansman who later went on to be a police officer in Atlanta and later became a grand wizard in the KKK. His connection to the agency has been all but wiped from record. There's many books and old news clippings that reference him as either the GBI director or a local Klansman and not Mary Benny that link the two together. And that was wild for me to uncover when I was looking into this. And the GBI and I have spoken about this
and what this did they particular say leader. About that? Were they forthcoming about the racist past that the agency has?
So I was able to get a lot of information quickly from the public affairs office, and the information stopped. You know, they were obviously also engaged in a very time and resource intensive investigation, but it was not lost on me that they did not respond to my question trying to confirm Sam Roper's identity, both as a leader of the KKK and a leader of the GBI. In conversations after the story went up, you know, we spoke about that. The GBI is pretty revered in Georgia. Vic Reynolds, the newest director, he has really brought a better sense of, I guess, what the law enforcement agency should be, and his reputation is you know pretty spotless among the people who I spoke to about how the GBI was handling this case. There's a clear separation between their current reputation and the reputation that they were built on as far as it relates to the KKK. However, there is this long track of time in between those two data points where there are cases where there's clear racial bias that, you know, either leads to a killing or a wrongful conviction. And there's also just cases of plain police brutality, that's indiscriminate of race and more indicative of a power dynamic that's exploitative.
Akayla, so who ultimately is the GBI accountable to? Is it Governor Brian Kemp?
So technically, yes. At the end of the day, the GBI will turn over what they find in the investigation and, referring to the Rashard Brooks case, to the Fulton County District Attorney, and they will be responsible for either, going forward with the prosecution of the police officer who shot him and has already been fired, Garrett Rolfe. The people who are responsible for delivering justice in this situation end up being the local DAs, but the GBI in a number of cases has come out later down the road and said that, local officers and GBI officers who, failed objectively to hold police who either killed people or wrongfully charged them accountable, they'll come out and say that that officers didn't do anything wrong, and families of victims who later get settlements or, you know, continue to reappeal these cases would probably have a different view of how the GBI has delivered justice or not done so in a number of cases in recent history and also going back to its inception.
Michaela, tell us where the Ahmaud Arbery case stands right now with the GBI.
So they are, you know, on the tail end of basically wrapping up the investigation. I spoke with the GBI a few weeks ago, I believe at the end of May, and there were agents that were still in Brunswick, but, you know, media attention had died down and they were getting ready to move things to the hearing, and GBI agents have testified. There's been some new details that have come out that, you know, the McMichaels hit Ahmaud Arbery with their truck. They yelled racial slurs at him after they shot him. Things that, you know, obviously point to explicit racism in the people who killed Ahmaud Arbery. The question is how the people listening to that testimony will be able to tie that to evidence of this being a racially motivated killing. The one of the biggest outrages when this first happened is that there is no statute for a hate crime in Georgia. So right now they're basically waiting for the outcome of that hearing. The third district attorney who took up the case and finally requested that the GBI take it up will then, you know, be responsible for dealing with the McMichaels and Roddy Bryan, who filmed the video, and, you know, anyone else who they've been investigating in the first two district attorney's offices who, you know, saw the video the day of that it happened and decided not to press charges.
Akela, and we know that the GBI is also going to be in charge of investigating the death of Rashard Brooks. Have they started that investigation yet?
Yes. And, you know, this is something that is, you could say it's a sign of the times or a fact of the matter that there's extreme media attention on these killings. That's the reason that the nation is seeing the most unrest since 1968. Ahmaud Arbery was shot and killed on February 23rd. The GBI took up his case on May 5th. The McMichaels were arrested on May 7th. In contrast with Rashard Brooks, he was shot and killed on June 12th. Vic Reynolds gave a press conference the next day. The GBI was already involved much more quickly than they were in the Arbery case. Obviously, that has to do with the time that the videos were released. The Atlanta police chief resigned. Garrett Rolfe was fired. The other officer was put on desk duty within a matter of days. Erica Shields, also the Atlanta police chief, just weeks ago was in a viral video of her speaking with protesters and de-escalating use of force by her officers. You know, she was upheld as this ideal of this is what officers should be doing. This is how we change the force. This is how we change. And on the flip side, some abolitionists and protesters would say that the best way to make change is to resign when you feel as if there's no more that you can do. Outwardly, that seems to be what happened with this situation with Erica Shields. I think that's a huge that tells us a lot about what this movement has already done and what changes have already come from it in such a short period of time, despite the tragic killings that continue to keep happening day after day.
So, Akela, you've done a lot of deep reporting into the GBI and its role in investigating police violence. But that reporting has also brought up some pretty personal feelings for you. Do you mind sharing some of that with us?
Yeah, sure. So I am Black. I'm half Black and half white. I have family who live in St. Simons Island, which is in the Brunswick area. I was there for a wedding last year. One of my family members is an ex-parole officer. Part of this story for many of us is reckoning with people in our lives who might be part of law enforcement, people in our lives who go about their lives every day fearing because of the color of their skin to varying degrees. And, you know, reckoning with my family about this brutal modern day lynching that took place, you know, just a few miles from where we all celebrated a wedding just about a year ago. It's terrifying. You know, I am somebody who has a lot of privilege, including that I'm white passing to most non-white people. I can go for a run without fearing that someone is going to think that I'm robbing a store. I'm a young woman. So many of these things were personal for many reasons, but the idea that the country is experiencing this amount of pain and anguish and eruption, and the state is responding with, you know, brute force, suggesting that the military be deployed to, and deploying the military to suppress some of this stuff. You know, I went home to Philadelphia for 2 weeks. My mom lives in the house that I grew up in outside of West Philly in East Lansdowne. And driving around, I passed the military with you know, large machine guns standing, you know, outside of her old office. You know, I go into the areas that I went to school in, and I see no police, no military, people going on about their lives like nothing's wrong. And it just makes you want to cry. You know, like, there's, at a certain point, there's not really anything else you can do. But, you know, there's some solace and also a deep disturbance in the fact that when the question is, can we have dignity for Black life? Can we have humanity for Black people? Which will, you know, translate into humanity for all people, the state will stop at nothing to continue to use force against its citizens. And that is, that's where I'm kind of left with this like bittersweet feeling that, yeah, finally things are changing, but it's never been more clear that the state doesn't want this to happen.
Akayla Lacey is a reporter with The Intercept. Akayla, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
I carry every day, yeah. This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Yeah, I'm a victim of recidivism. I only be civilized in a prison system. Yeah, religious stigma keep a sinner's vision. Skin stigma's a bigger division. It can't be mended, it's cemented and demented. My window's tinted and my skin is, which one is it? When you violate my rights and my amendments.
That's Sigs, a song from B.L. Sherelle off the album Asada Troy, which comes out later this week. B.L. is also the deputy director of the record label Die Jim Crow, and that's the first nonprofit record label for formerly and currently incarcerated people. Artists and producers with Die Jim Crow travel to different facilities around the country and record music with people currently behind bars.
And we go in for maybe a week, and we just literally record. I mean, people forget where they are. You know, like, we just are in the lab, a bunch of creative musical masters just creating music.
I could barely get fresh, wore that designer rarely, till I did that math, like, hold up, that one I gotta carry.
I sat down with BL to talk about her music, her activism with the label, what this moment in history means to her, and how exactly Die Jim Crow started.
So, interestingly enough, it started from a concept album called Die Jim Crow. My executive director, his name is Fury Young. He wanted to produce a conceptual album about Jim Crow in general, telling the story of mass incarceration to up to date. He was looking for artists to write songs for this album. And I wrote two records for an EP that we did put out. And we had so much material left over from a lot of the prisons that we went to, so many talented, beautiful musicians. But it didn't quite fit the format of the album because the album was conceptual and it was very concise in its direction. So we were just wondering, well, what do we do with this extra material? You know, do we give it to like their families? Do we, I mean, what do we do? And that's kind of when we became an organization because it was all about an album originally.
So BL, I want to stop you there because I think this is really interesting because you're helping produce music with your own music, with other musicians, with the label, but you're also recording with people who are currently incarcerated, right?
Correct.
How do
Correct.
You do that?
It's very hard. The hardest part is the access, getting access. Interestingly enough, we've had a lot of success getting access down south in states like South Carolina. We worked in Mississippi. We've done work in Ohio. We've also done work in Oklahoma, but they let us come in and we have band directors who we work with very closely. And when we come in, they're already, they've been practicing, they've been writing, they've been doing everything they need to do. But we have very talented musicians, wonderful writers. Our band directors are beautiful people. Some of them, you know, really serious and heinous, you know, situations. But they have grew into beautiful people, beautiful characters. And yeah, we go in and we record with them. And then after that, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in post, and we make great, great, great freaking music. I think at the end of the day, that's what we stand on the most, is the quality of our music.
BL, you said that when you go into prisons and record, sometimes people forget where they are for a moment. And I think for people who are incarcerated, that must feel like a relief.
Yeah, well, I had it happen to me. I was working with my artist, B. Alexis, and she's in South Carolina. She's serving a 30-year sentence. She's been incarcerated since she was 17. And she's about 28, 29 now. And when it was time to leave, it just hit me like, wow, she's not coming with us. Like, you know, because we were just so busy just working every day. I mean, you come, we there 7 a.m. We don't leave till 6 p.m. and we do the whole thing all over again, you know? And I feel like I could see it in her too, where she kind of realized I got to go back to the unit, you know, and go on this merry-go-round, this never ending wheel. It was really, really incredibly sad, honestly. But when you think about it, it's beautiful in its moment. You know, all walks of life. We have people who have never been in prison sometimes come in and help us out. Grammy Award winning musicians and things like that. And to even see them at first come in very uptight and kind of scary and, you know, not really loose. And then they kind of, after a few days, they forgetting where they at too. You know, they cussing, they, you know, they getting in their bag, you know. So it's the ultimate equalizer, music is, in my opinion. And that's why we, you know, do what we do.
Well, and it's something, you know, it's a population that I think is often talked about, but not talked to directly, incarcerated folks, and largely, you know, we're talking about Black and brown and poor people. And you yourself, you spent 10 years behind bars. Tell me a little bit about what your background is, because I know that for a lot of people who end up in the system, there's usually some sort of complicated history there.
Yeah. So my story is really, really very typical. To a point, my mother was an addict. By the time I was probably 12 years old, I was ingratiated into the lifestyle of selling drugs. So by the time I was about 17, me and my mother were co-defendants on 3 separate occasions. This was more like a family business. This is how I was raised. It was very normalized in my household. And I had a very strong grandmother. So it's not like I had no moral compass at all. But I was pretty much groomed in that environment. And, you know, I'm 32, so I've been on some type of supervision or probation or incarcerated since I was 12 years old. This year is the first year in 20 years that I've been completely free.
When you say completely free, so our listeners understand what that means, you're talking about not being on parole or anything, right?
Right. March 27th of this year, I was finally released off of parole, any type of supervision. So this is the first time I've had this experience since I was 12. And basically, I was groomed into, you know, doing these things. I was a very smart kid. You know, the moral compass was different when my mom was under her addiction. And she's clean, by the way. I can never bring that up without always saying she's been clean for about 13, 14 years now. But, you know, by the time I was 13, I was selling crack to my mother. By the time I was 18, I was serving a 12-year sentence for aggravated assault against an undercover police officer who pulled a weapon out on me, and I pulled the weapon back, and we exchanged fire, and I was shot multiple times, beaten really bad, but I'm still alive, and that's not, you know, what a lot of people can say for a lot smaller things. So sometimes I struggle with a little survivor's remorse behind that I actually survived something like that, but yeah, that's what happened.
BL, that's a really complicated story, and I think something that I appreciate you sharing that with us. I know a lot of people don't like to talk about the stories that got them into the system, and so I appreciate you sharing that story with us. The album that's going to be released by Die Jim Crow Records is called Asada Troy. It's coming out on June 19th. What's the name of the album mean?
The name of the album just means she who struggles is a warrior. So Asada is she who struggles. And that's what I was going to name my child who didn't, you know, make it all the way here. So this is my new baby. And I was going to name her Asada Troy because I love Asada Shakur, number one. I love what she stands for and I love what the name stood for. And, you know, Troy is an uncle of mine who passed away. So we were going to, that was going to be our daughter's name. But the reason why is because, you know, she who struggles is a warrior. And that's how I feel about my life. I've been through a lot. I fit into so many different, you know, categories as far as, you know, sexual abuse victim, felon, you name it, lesbian, black, I mean, fat. I mean, I could just keep going on and on. And all it has done is, you know, made me very strong, gave me very thick skin. And it has truly, all my life experiences have, I really feel like a warrior. I really feel like, you know, a survivor. I don't always play, I'm not playing victim here, because a lot of these things I did on my own, you know, but I wasn't dealt the best hand either. So I'm really proud of how far I came.
A lot of the music in your album is very reflective of these experiences. I'm going to play a clip from the song Cigs. Let's take a listen.
I'm a victim of recidivism. I only be civilized in the prison system. Yeah, religious stigma keep a sinner's vision. Skin stigma's a bigger division. It can't be minted, it's cemented and demented. My window's tinted and my skin is, which one is it? When you violate my rights and my amendments, same rights was never given to begin with. I'd rather ask for forgiveness than...
There's a line in there, BL, that says, when you violate my rights and my amendments, those same rights were never given to begin with. BL, you mentioned all the things. You said you fit into multiple categories. You're a felon, you're black, you're fat, you're a lesbian. What did that do in terms of how you were treated in the criminal justice system?
That's interesting. That's a good question. I can give you a little example. I went to trial for the shooting with the undercover police officer because I wasn't aware that he was a police officer. And that was my argument. Hey, this guy pulled a gun out on me. I didn't know who he was. I was trying to protect myself. And that's the God honest truth. And of course, you know, when you go to a job interview, right, you're not going to go how you may lounge around in your house or how you may hang around on your block. So I was dressed what I deemed appropriately for court. And the DA, she just kept passing around pictures of what I looked like outside of the courtroom. And I thought that was really interesting. For some reason, she kept trying to bring that as evidence in the trial. And instead of, you know, what they saw in front of them, me put together looking like I'm going to court, she just kept trying to reinforce how I may look when I'm out on the street living my life. And I think that, you know, that was a part of just trying to create that aesthetic of for, yeah, she doesn't look like what we said she did right now, but look at this picture. I bet she looks like what she said, what we're saying she did. Does that make sense?
It does. No, it does. And it often speaks a lot to how people are portrayed. I've done a lot of reporting around images that are used for Black people who have been arrested and mugshots and everything in terms of how that affects the ultimate perception of Black people in the system. So I totally understand. I do want to get to another song of yours called Conspiracy. Let's play a clip from that song.
It's been 15, you've been in 1,000 roommates you live with. A new dude with a box walk in, you realize it's your kid. He don't even remember you, even though you're identical. Guess the cycle continues. Yes, the cycle continues. This is the system. Jail on the prison. Realize nobody miss you.
BL, that song talks a lot about incarceration as a generational issue, something that you are intimately familiar with, given the story that you told us about your mother and you. What is it about the system overall that you want people who are listening to this music to understand?
I would want them to understand that women are at the fastest growing rate of being in prison right now. And we face so many different challenges than the men. Deliberate indifference to our health care. I have seen countless women die due to just not being diagnosed, due to screaming that something's wrong with them every single day, no one caring, and we don't have a lot of support. So women are getting locked up for having addictions, getting locked up for being abused, being locked up for all kinds of things that can be out-resourced elsewhere to get help for these things. And then we don't have the support inside, nor do we have the same support returning. And unlike men, the women race demographics are different. Like in Pennsylvania, it's a whole lot of white women inside of the penitentiary. I just want people to understand that women are being incarcerated at such a fast, such a high rate, and they're losing their children. And I wish that we could point more of our resources towards the women who are facing this.
You're talking about women incarcerated women of all races who are behind bars. And we know that this is a real issue, from women who don't have sanitary napkins behind bars to women who are forced to give birth in shackles. I mean, the list goes on and on about the sort of treatment that women who are incarcerated face. One of the other places that women, particularly Black women, are ignored often is in when it comes to this, the fight for social justice in this country. I'm thinking of Breonna Taylor, and I'm thinking of the uprisings that we're seeing across the country. And there's now been a focus on Breonna. But of course, we're also talking about the death of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many other Black men and women who have been killed at the hands of police officers. What do you feel when you look around and you see Black Lives Matter now taking center stage across the country?
I feel hopeful, but at the same time, I'm not looking for a Black Lives Matter Boulevard. I'm not looking for Black Lives Matter on the street on Washington, D.C. I'm looking for policy change. I'm looking for structural change. I don't care if an officer takes a knee at the protest. Call me, you know, maybe pessimistic or negative or whatever, but I need to see policy changes. I'm not here for all the, you know, symbolism. I would like people, every company that's posting Black Lives Matter, I would like to see your hire record and see how much Black Lives Matter in your company. You know, I'm not here for just everybody just jumping on the trend. I would like to see in 6 months, when no one else is talking about this, what policies we have put in place and what these companies and all these celebrities and everyone else who's jumping on the bandwagon for now, how much they have actually applied Black Lives Mattering.
B.L. Sherrill is an artist and the deputy director of Die Jim Crow, the first nonprofit record label for formerly and currently incarcerated people. Her new album, Asada Troy, will be out on June 19th. B.L., thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And everybody, continue to fight. I appreciate it. I'm proud of everyone. Let's keep applying pressure. Let's keep marching. Let's keep signing these petitions. Let's keep donating to these families. And let's keep fighting, please.
So we're going to be talking a lot more about art in this moment and how it matters to social change. So stay tuned for more on that in the coming days and weeks. And I want to say one more thing before we end the show today. We've been having some really heavy and necessary conversations on the program lately. And so many of us are struggling under the sheer weight of the news and everything that's happening around us. I know a lot of folks are struggling through it. To that end, I've been really trying to find small moments of joy. And recently, for me, that's meant supporting businesses that create really pretty masks for me to wear when I'm outside, because if we have to wear masks, I want to enjoy it. I'd love to hear from listeners in terms of where you're finding joy. Are there tiny little things that you're doing now that are bringing a smile to your face? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave us a message. Until tomorrow, I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.